Good morning, everyone. Let's all take a moment then to make our veneration to the Buddha, he who represents the truth, he who is our father, our guide, our teacher, and laid down the path for us so that all of us could walk in the noble path and achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
So you've added a few extra rows. You're closer to the Sangha now. Beware. This could be infectious. But how close are you really to the Sangha? To be close to the Sangha is to be the Sangha, or at least to become the Sangha. Not necessarily someone in a robe. In fact, there may even be people who are in a robe but are yet to become Sangha. But if within your heart, within your mind, a transformation has begun to take place, and you're beginning to experience freedom. Freedom that transcends words. Freedom is just a word. That's not freedom, is it? Freedom, it's just a word. In every language they'll have a word. But the word itself is not freedom. Freedom is something that you experience. Sometimes you don't know what freedom is until you have experienced it. There were many, even in the Buddha's era, people thought that they were free, because back then there was slavery. So they were the free people and then they were the slaves. But when they went to listen to the Buddha's teaching, they realized that they were all slaves. There were those who were slaves to others, and then there were those who were slaves to themselves. True freedom only comes from within. These talks are for that purpose, to help you free yourself from the burden that you experience day in, day out. From the burden of motherhood. Mothers, I talk to you. I want you to experience the freedom from the burden of motherhood. You don't have to give up your son or your daughter for that. But you know that as a mother, you have many sleepless nights. Every other day you are crying about something, and then the other day you are worrying about something. Every joy that you experience is always tainted with fear. You find a good school for your child, so you take them and put to the school. Now they are enrolled in one of the best schools in the country. That gives you a sense of joy. But then at the same time, you're also worried, what might they be exposed to now? It's one of the best schools because there, they have all the facilities, the best teaching, the best classrooms. Every child has a laptop. And they're connected to the internet. So, with every little joy that you experience, you also have to endure the pain of fear. When your child comes home and says that they have won the gold medal, now you can be certain that they have become the target, perhaps of bullies, maybe those who want to snatch that position from them. There will be those who don't like them anymore. So it will be a constant battle. So as a mother, now you're burdened. It's one thing to do your duty for your child, but it's another to feel the burden of motherhood. That's what I want to free you from. And you know that your child is like a drop of water hanging on the end of a blade of grass, because they are alive just like yours. And all life is very temporary. If your happiness depends on their life, all you need to completely destroy whatever happiness you experience right now is just a message from them, or a call from them, or someone you know, to say that they have had an accident, or they have taken a turn for the worse, they're ill, they've been taken to hospital. Some of you, your children are abroad, aren't they? They've gone there for further studies. Maybe some of them have settled in foreign countries. You brought them up, they were the apple of your eye, you looked after them. But then at some point, you married them off, and now, whether that is your son or your daughter, they don't live at home anymore. Now they're abroad. They're with someone else. So now you're at the mercy of your daughter-in-law or your son-in-law. Will they look after her just as well as you did? Who knows? Will they mistreat her? Who knows? Will she open up with you in case she has problems? Who knows? Or will she keep it all inside and just bottle it all up? These are the fears that run in every mother's mind and every mother's heart. When your son has to leave for school or has to leave for work, and then on the news the other day, or in the newspapers the other day, you read that there's drugs everywhere. Now you're worried. You're scared. And when you see the stats that get published every year of how pornography is completely bringing the nation's youth to its knees, then you're scared. You're worried. What might it do to your boy? This boy that you looked after, you doted on. The one who you try to take care of so painstakingly, all those days and nights. I'm not talking about duty and responsibility. I also have a duty and responsibility, and that is what I'm here to fulfill. If we are citizens in this world, we have a duty and a responsibility to each other, the people with whom we share this planet. We have a duty and responsibility to the trees, to the rivers, to the oceans, to the sky above our heads and the ground below our feet. We have a responsibility to nature. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the burden that you experience, the pain and the fear that you go through, the suffering that you have to endure, ladies and gentlemen. This Dhamma, these sermons, these talks, are to help free you from that. The extent to which you experience that freedom is the extent to which the Sangha has begun to happen within your hearts and minds. So I want you to get closer to the Sangha. See, if there was an ant on my fan right now, That ant is very close to me. Much closer, far closer than any of you can ever get, probably. Don't try it. But that ant is never going to be Sangha. It doesn't even know what the heck's going on. At least you know what's going on with you right now. But that Sangha has to happen within you. Freedom from ignorance, freedom from attachment, freedom from vexation, freedom from the burden of motherhood, freedom from the burden of fatherhood. I'm not suggesting for one moment that you must give up your families or give up your worldly possessions. It's not that. But think about this for a second. All your material possessions, they give you a sense of achievement, yes. They give you a sense of entitlement, yes. They give you a sense of ownership, yes. But they also give you a sense of fear. Every material possession you have. As I was driving up, I saw all those cars parked outside the car park. Nice, you've got some nice cars. You like that, but then there are others who don't like that. The fact that you have a nice car is both a blessing and a curse. How can you escape one without escaping the other? It's like two sides of a coin. Can you only have one side and not the other? You can't do that. The watch that you wear on your wrist, the more expensive it is, the heavier it feels on your heart. The necklace that goes around your neck, the more expensive it is, the heavier it feels, not just physically, but also psychologically. How about your daughter? If she's pretty, a mother, a father would be very proud. But only while she's at home. You're scared to send her out. You can't send her alone in public transport. You can't put her on a train or a bus. Because you're not the only one who thinks that she's pretty. Others will do the same. But they will not look at her with motherly affection as you do. For them, it's just an opportunity. So how can you be proud as a mother, the mother of a beautiful daughter? How can you be just proud and nothing more? You can't, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry to say this, but you can't. But any mother, when she's pregnant, what does she wish for? Why does she go and make offerings? Bodhi puja. As a mother, I've seen some mothers, they have pictures of cute, cuddly babies on their walls, right? In their bedrooms. It is said that if you keep staring at it long enough, your baby might be just as beautiful. You don't know what you're wishing for. See, there is nothing in this world that can only be a blessing and not a curse at the same time, unless you speak of Nibbana. I guarantee that. Nibbana is the only sukha. It is the only bliss that does not come with strings attached. Every other gain that you have always comes with strings attached. And remember, it then matters who's on the other end of that string. Sometimes it'll be a friend, other times it'll be an enemy. whenever you gain something, remember you not only make friends, but you also make enemies. You have a nice house, don't you? Good, I'm happy for you. But remember, not everyone's like me. There are those who don't like that. There are those who envy you because you have a nice house. So be careful with whom you talk about the fact that you have a nice house, or you live in a good part of the neighborhood, or the fact that you just bought a new car. Some will like it, some will not. So what do we do? Shall we go and fix everyone? Shall we go and try and make friends with everyone? Are you friends with everyone you know? Is everyone you know a friend of yours? To know someone and to be a friend are two different things, right? There you go. Not everyone you know is a friend of yours. Sometimes you have to know your enemies better than you know your friends. Why? Well, you've got to watch out. There are some people you would never invite into your house. You know them, but you'd never invite them. There are some people you'd never leave your daughter or your son with. Agreed or not? Yes, but you know them. See, everything comes with strings attached. So that's the kind of life that you're going to have to expect and put up with and endure until, ladies and gentlemen, you discover that there is a joy, there is a bliss that comes with no strings attached. And that joy is the joy of Nibbana. That bliss is the bliss of Nibbana, nothing else. Present to me, I challenge you, one other thing that only comes with benefits, only comes with advantages, no disadvantages. Sorry to say that there's nothing you can think of. Some people wish to win the lottery, don't they? Maybe even you do. Or maybe you have done in the past. Maybe you still do. Every weekend you buy the, what do you call it? Shanidhavasana. Or maybe now it's online lottery. Whatever. What are you hoping for? The jackpot. I'll be happy for you if you win it. But trust me, not everyone's like me. I'll be happy for you because I don't want it. You must only trust me for one reason. You know, let me lay it out there. Let's be candid. You must only trust me for one reason, and that is, you have nothing that I want. That's why. You cannot trust a man who wants what you have. I'm sorry to put it so bluntly, but that's the truth. You cannot trust a man who wants what you have. Because if they want what they have, and they will bear it until it comes to a point, but once they pass that threshold, once it goes past that point of what we call patience, now they have become a patient. And the only way that they can be relieved of their internal suffering is if they somehow find a way to acquire what you possess. Some of them will come and ask you nicely the first time, "Sir, may I have your daughter's hand in marriage, please?" And you think to yourself, "Well, what a gentleman. So polite. So refined." So then you take a moment to learn about them, study about them, and then you realize that his uncle's nephew, his uncle's nephew's grandfather's grandson's daughter's son-in-law is a drug addict. No, you're not interested. No, you don't want that. You don't want that black mark on your family. So you say, put out. We'll see later. Just do your studies now. Just do your studies. We'll see about that later. Sure, whatever you say, uncle. First it was sir, now it has become uncle. So a few months later, he comes and asks you again. Uncle, what do you say now? I've completed my studies. Well, what you wanted to say the first time, you were not able to. Nothing's changed. The guy's still doing drugs. So now you want him to stop asking you because it's become a nuisance. And someone else in the family is expecting your daughter's hand. Those things happen as well, right? Sometimes distant relations. Sometimes you are bound. Those things happen as well. So then you say again, a second time, Tata, you know what, we'll see. But I think she has someone else in her mind. But we'll talk with her and get back to you. He doesn't like the sound of that. It's not what he wanted to hear. You can't trust him because he wants something that you have. I'll tell you what, by the third time he comes asking for your daughter's hand, either make your mind up and let him have her, or go hide her somewhere. Maybe send her abroad, or dig a deep cave somewhere and hide her in there, or at least put her in a coffin 6 feet under, or whatever, do something and hide her. Otherwise, I'll tell you what, he's going to have her by hook or by crook. And what's even worse, it's become very trendy these days that if he can't have her, he'll make sure that no one else can. There are many ways in which you can do that. One way is, within air quotes, steal her innocence. I don't think I need to spell it out to you. Apparently that's a trend now. You just have to steal her innocence. Because then that gives them a sense of, I got from her something that no one else will ever get. So now she's just used goods. He was never going to have her, but fine, that's okay now. I have got my fill. No one else is going to have her the way that I had her. The other way is, you can always permanently disfigure her. You can permanently disfigure her. There are these liquids called acids. I don't know whether you've heard of them. They come in bottles. All you have to do is hide in the dark, in a dark alley somewhere. And as your daughter passes, she's only gone for her classes, tuition classes, on her way back home. All they have to do is splash a bit of that on her face. Now that little flower that you brought up, that daughter of yours, who was so pretty, so innocent, so beautiful, the sin was not letting someone who was interested in her have her. That was the sin that you committed. And because of that, she now has to pay the price. And you will have to live with a girl, either at home, who no longer anyone's going to find interested, and also someone who's going to have to suffer for the rest of their life. So once again, this is the burden of motherhood. This is the burden of fatherhood. If you win the lottery, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be happy for you, but not everyone's going to be. You know, people will come after you. They'll come and pretend that they are your friends. You know they're not friends. See the burden of motherhood? What can I say? If you still keep looking for happiness in a child, ladies and gentlemen, you will end up there, and then you won't even be able to listen to a sermon. See, I know one thing for certain. The poor mother, while she was here, she was probably struggling to pay attention to what I was saying, because she was probably thinking, is this ghost is this a disturbance to everyone else in the room? So she was not able to pay attention, likely. No one else here had that worry, because she's the mother. And no one points the finger at the child, everyone points the finger at the parent. The burden of motherhood. I can give you a long list, 1,000 things and more, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not against anyone having children. I'm not against the idea. We have your children now. You had enough of them, we took them over. I'm not against having children. Otherwise, why would we have a children's home? When we first started, it was a children's home, actually. Now it is the children's home, the monastery. But initially, we had a children's home at the monastery. So actually, we wanted to take children who were orphans. So we went and talked to the authorities. And initially we had a few children, but I think their merits ran out. So initially we had several of them, but later on many of them left. Because the authorities thought that they were not getting the best of what they could be getting. Because we were more focused on instilling values and virtues in the children. That's not to say they don't get an education, but we are more focused on that. What good is a doctor? What good is an engineer? If all they have is a brain but no heart? What good is a heart surgeon who doesn't have one? Don't you think so? See, I'm happier today not because of everything I learnt at university. I'm happier than I was today because of the Dhamma that I have understood. I have found freedom within me. And that is what we strive to share with everyone. Because I know, ladies and gentlemen, that no matter what you do, no matter where you go, you will always circle back around and come here. Let's say today you decide, you know what, Swaminathan, these sermons are a waste of time. I don't want to spend my Sundays here. I'm just going to go and do something else, something that will actually make you happy, make me happy. You'll say that. I say, oh, fine, go, try it out. 100 years later, you'll still come back and say, didn't work out. See, you don't need to go and try out 100 different things, because there are 100 people in this hall right now. they've saved you the effort. That you might be convinced that the path you took is not, does not work out. So you might think, well, I'm going to try a different path. Hey, you don't have to. Speak to the person sat next to you. And the person sat behind you. In front of you and on the side of you. They have gone on that journey on your behalf. So why go through the hassle of it? Just ask them. So if you think you're not happy today because you wanted to do medicine when you were younger, but your mother wanted you to become a dancer, or your mother wanted you to do medicine and you wanted to become a dancer, and that's why you're not happy today. There are people who've gone both journeys in this room, so just tap them on the shoulder and ask them, are you happy? Actually, you know what? I can do one better. You don't need to ask them. They're here. The proof is in the pudding. The fact that they're here is evidence that they don't work. The fact that I'm here is evidence that happiness is not in the United Kingdom. I had to go through all that to learn a lesson the hard way. The fact that I am here is evidence that happiness is not in money. I thought it was, and that's why I went and worked in a bank. Soon after graduation, that's what I wanted to do. I went into a bank, and one of the best banks at the time. The fact that I am here is evidence. And you can trust me. Why? Because you don't have anything that I want. That's why. Even if you had it, I wouldn't be able to take it from you. See, it's not the Dhamma that helps you free. Understanding of the Dhamma is what helps you free yourself. I could force you to preach the Dhamma to me, but I can't steal your understanding, can I? That's yours. What you have understood is yours. I can't steal that from you. I can't snatch it from you. That's yours. No one can take it from you. That's why we're here. Yesterday I was talking to our Anagarika daughters at the monastery, a group of them. So we have a program called Little Britain. I've mentioned about this in the past. We have one for the boys and one for the girls as well. So yesterday I was talking to the girls. So we sat down and I asked them to get into groups of three and preach the doctrine. And the other two would ask questions, because we are preparing them so that they can engage in this great battle against Mara. Because when you come to the monastery, I want them ready to help you. So, towards the end of that, I explained to them, I said, Dua, interesting fact. I said, Dua, did you know that as a girl, you are born with all the eggs that you will ever have in your ovaries? Science. You're never going to have more than you're born with. So if you were in your lay lives and potentially went on to become mothers, there's a limit to how many children you can mother. Because the most you can mother are the number of eggs you have, and you're born with that. You can never have more than that. So there's a limit to the number of children you can mother as a biological mother. But I said, if you continue your life as an Anagarika, you're not going to become mothers. Certainly not biological mothers. But then there's something better than that. You can become spiritual mothers. And there's no limit to that. The limit is how many people you can fit in your heart. How many crying souls you can fit in your heart. How many people towards whom you can have compassion and loving kindness. If you can have that towards the whole world, then you can become a mother to the whole world. So why limit yourself to becoming a biological mother when you can go on to become a spiritual mother? And every man, woman and child in this world, you can consider your child. And then I also went on to say, let me prove the point to you. So we did a little bit of a practical exercise. Shall we do it here as well? Just to prove a point. Alright, you'll have to get up when I say so. Okay? Is that alright? Okay. Alright, why don't you all get up for a second? Right. Now here's what I want you to do. If you remember your mother's, well, if you know your mother's full name, her full name, remain standing. The rest of you, please sit down. You must know your mother's full name, not initials. You must know her full name. Excellent, good. So all of you do. Next question. If you know your father's full name, please keep standing. The rest of you sit down. Excellent. They're all stand. Oh, one sat down. This is nothing personal. It's just to prove a point. And please don't feel embarrassed or no one's judging you, okay? Circumstances. Next question. Let's see how you face this one. If you know your grandmother's full name, please keep standing. The rest of you sit down. Ah, half of you have sat down already. If you also know your grandfather's full name, please keep standing. The rest of you can sit down. Good. If you know your great-grandmother's full name, some of you still do. You're a great sport. Thank you, madam. So we did this activity with them. None of them knew their grandmother's full name. They're still young. Maybe one or two did, but the others didn't. But then that helped me prove the point. You know, I said, my grandmother, she had 11 children, my grandmother. I think I still remember her full name. But I'm not sure. I think I still remember her full name. See how soon they're forgotten. How soon they're forgotten. If you make it your life's purpose to become a mother, two generations down the line, they won't even remember your name. Just like you don't remember your grandmother's name. But she might have carried you, fed you, looked after you, played with you when you wanted her companionship. But you don't even remember her name now. Great-grandmother? So then the day you become a grandmother, sooner than you become a great-grandmother, people will have forgotten you. That's because there are plenty of grandmothers and great-grandmothers and people like that around. You are not unique or special in any way in that regard. But then if you go back 2,500 years, we still talk about Bhadra Kachayana, the great Theru Nirvansa. We still talk about Ananda Theru. You know, do you know more about your grandfather or about the great Ananda Theru? Point proven. Do you know more about Sariputta Theru or about your great-grandfather? See, the great Sariputta Theru, he lived 2,500 years ago. Your great-grandfather? Not more than 100 years ago, he was alive. So then, what about the day you become a grandfather? You'll soon be forgotten. But what if you become like the great elder Sariputta Thera? Then your legacy will live on forever. That's what I mean, ladies and gentlemen. It's overrated. Once again, I'm not suggesting for one moment that you must not consider becoming mothers, fathers, grandparents and so on. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, that doesn't make you special in any way. You have all been gifted with a chance to do something great for this world. They call him Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma means the great soul. That was not his lay name. That was not the name that he was christened with. But then he went on to become someone great. He went on to serve mankind in whatever way that he could, in the ways that he understood. His message was that of non-violence. To a nation that was torn with conflict, he gave the message of non-violence. He wanted to achieve something. He wanted to fight for something. But he chose the method of non-violence, which was not the chosen method back then. And people likened to that. And so even today, in our textbooks, we learn about him. But do you think your grandfather is mentioned in your textbooks at school? That's what I mean. So the day you become a grandfather, that's nothing special. You know, you have all been gifted with a human life to become something and someone special. Do something spectacular. Give yourself as a gift to mankind. If I was a layperson, how many of you would know me by now? None of us. None of you would know me. Because I'd just be another banker. How many bankers are there? Some would say far too many. And you wouldn't be interested in what I had to say. Because you wouldn't trust me. Because I want something that you have. So every time I come and talk to you, that will be a sales pitch. That's what it will always be, a sales pitch. I might get onto a stage and talk to you and dazzle you and impress you, but you will always be a little bit suspicious when I ask you to sign the dotted line. You'll ask me, what's the catch? Won't you? You'll ask me, what's the catch? If I came and said, why don't you come and spend a week with me? Say, I was a banker at my place. Come and spend a week with me. For free. All expenses paid. What would you say? you know, put me to a side. If your boss said, come and spend a week at my place, or they're going to send you for a week to Hawaii, all expenses paid, and all of a sudden they just call you to the office and say, you know, we're going to send you for a week to Hawaii, all expenses paid. Okay? You say, okay. What's the question you're going to ask him before you leave the office? What is it you want from me? Or they come and say, you know what, we've decided to give you a pay rise. For the last 10 years, nothing. But all of a sudden they say, we're going to decide to give you a pay rise. Or we've decided to give you a company car. What are you going to say? Okay. Or is he going to say, yeah, fine, okay. No. You're going to say what? Okay. You'll be, you know, those wrinkles on your frown, on your forehead. Eh? Okay. What's the catch? Because it's not Nibbana they're offering you. You know that your boss wants something from you, something that you have. You have time, they want it. You have skill, and they want it. You have competence, and they want it. You have knowledge, and they want it. In exchange, you want something they have. So if you walked up to the office of your boss and said, sir, yes, I want to work weekends for you as well. You know, I've only been doing work weekdays. I want to start working weekends. And I don't want to take any holidays from here on. What's your boss going to say? Okay. Why is that? Because he knows that you want something that he has. That's why trust is such a fragile thing. So fragile. So fragile. So fragile because the two parties that form this trust relationship, it's not so much really a trust relationship, it's more like a suspicion relationship. It's always tainted with suspicion, doubt. So there's always a sense of dubiousness. And who can be blamed? Who can be blamed, I ask? How can you be blamed when you can't stop yourself from wanting things? So I don't blame you for that. I can't blame your boss for that. You can't either. You can't blame anyone, ladies and gentlemen. You can't. You know, unless and until you're armed with the Dhamma, how can you expect anyone to stop wanting something? You know, you've lived through life long enough to understand that although you might have sheer willpower, there are times when the mind is willing but the flesh is weak, they say. But the contrary is the truth. The flesh is always willing. Yeah, you're looking this way, do you feel like your arm going to the freezer, or to the fridge, to the chocolate? Hey, what are you doing? Come back. That never happens. Your arm doesn't sleepwalk to the fridge and help itself to the chocolate or the ice cream, the soft drinks. Doesn't do that. It's the mind that's always weak. But how can he be blamed for that? If you're not equipped with the Dhamma, who can be blamed? That's why in this game, we don't judge anyone. That's the first thing I'm going to say. We don't judge anyone. If you're a womanizer, I don't judge you. Because it's not your fault, technically. But that's not what people will say. They will try you in a court of law, and then they will punish you. If you're a married man or a married woman, and you're caught having relationships with someone else, then that is a punishable offense. And what is the punishment? You know, the real punishment should be, they should preach the Dhamma to you. That should be the real punishment, because there's no other way can you guarantee that that individual will not do such a thing again. Because putting them in a prison cell does not stop them from wanting something. That happens in the mind. What have you just imprisoned? The body. Desire arises in the mind. Then imprison the mind? No, they imprison the body. Your kid wants to watch TV. He wants to watch the games, watch films, but you want them to go and do their studies. And then you try one or two times, it doesn't work, and then you pick up the cane. You think you can beat desire out of someone? Corporal punishment? Do you really think you can beat desire out of your kid? But until your kids realize that you have now started to find solutions through the Dhamma, they're going to be dead scared to come and open up with parents. We find that a lot. Young children, young people, they come up to us and they say, Swami Nasa, you know, you are the only person I can talk to. They come and young girls come and talk to Anagarika Mahapis and they say, Mahatmi, you're the only one I can talk to. You're the only one I can open with, because I can't say these things to my parents because they don't understand me. Yes, they have a point. They don't understand me is what they say. They have a point. Because to the mother, to the father, all they see is my son, my daughter. What they don't see is, this is just another mind. It's not your son or daughter that desires things, ladies and gentlemen. Minds desire things. But if you filter your view and you look through the lens of, this is my child, so my child should do as I say. That's not your child, that's a mind. That's a mind. A mind will do what ignorance and attachment dictates. Whatever the mind bears, that's going to be the mind's doctrine. And the mind then executes the code that's on it. It's like a computer. The software is the Dhamma. It could be Buddha Dhamma, it could be Mara Dhamma. Whatever that code is, that's the software on the mind. And then the mind is going to execute that. It's very important, ladies and gentlemen, for you to understand this concept. Not just so that you treat yourselves more graciously, kindly, softly, but also those around you. It's important that you open your eyes and you realize that your kid is not your kid, it's just another mind. Your next door neighbor, maybe they're very noisy and they're always partying and making a lot of noise, and you might think they're very inconsiderate. To you, they're neighbors, but all there is what? Just a mind. And if that mind thinks that singing, dancing, music, that's what fun is, that's what they're going to do. So what should you do then? Put a speaker, turn into their house, and play the Dhamma. Give them some of their own medicine. No, don't do that. That's why last week we talked a lot about the fact that it's all in the mind. Your whole world is your mind. It's what you think, it's your thoughts. The Dhamma is to re-engineer your thought process. That's what the Dhamma is for. You've already been engineered in a certain way. Some say it's in your DNA. I see more like it's part of your nurture, right from your younger years, the indoctrinations that you've had. There are some aspects you bring from your previous lives, yes, but a lot of it is about how you're nurtured. The things that we've learned from our parents, from our relations, from our siblings, from our teachers, from the books that we've read, other sources we've associated with. The things that people taught you were right, but not weren't necessarily. Remember, every year, at the end of the school term, what were we taught to do? I remember very, very, very well. Every year, at the end of the school term, we'd wait for the last day of the term, right? And then what do kids do in school? They party. So our picnic spot was Parliament grounds. At the end of school, we'd go to the Parliament grounds and we'd play, and there'd be food and drinks, and that's what we used to do. And then on the way back from school, that was the day where you have to close all the windows of your school bus. Why? Because what do people do for fun? Not just the singing. They splash water at each other. You just think about it. Why do people do that? I mean, these are human beings. We splash water at each other. Just take a very objective view at it and tell me what sense that makes. For fun, here's what humans do. They splash water at each other. Imagine the aliens arrived on planet Earth, right? And it's the end of the school, right? School term break. And these students who had been schooled in this school, all the schools around the country, right? They've been learning science and math and social studies and history and geography and biology and all that, right? So they've been learning all that for the last 3 months, okay? So then this is the last day of school. On the way home, what do? They splash water at each other. What do you think aliens are going to think about our schooling system? And apparently that's fun. Apparently that's fun. But if you've ever been the victim of that, whether it was fun or not was a very subjective matter. Especially if you had classes or something else that you had to go to after that. But then these are the things that have been put into young people's minds. That's what you are supposed to do. You're supposed to party. You're supposed to drinks, food, dance, and splash water at each other. That's what you're supposed to do at the end of a school term. What? Humans? I don't know whether you can resonate with what I'm trying to get across to you here, but why is that fun? What is the fun part of it? Is it the filling the bottle up with water? What part of it is fun? Is it the squeezing the bottle, the actual squeezing? If that was fun, then you can just keep doing that all day. That should be fun. You know what? That has become fun because it causes discomfort to someone else. That's why comedy is fun. It shouldn't be. Sorry. May I continue? Comedy is not supposed to be fun. When you see someone walking along the street and they slip over a banana peel and fall, right? What did we learn to do? Laugh. See? Someone's been put into a state of great discomfort and we were taught to laugh about it. And do you know how we were taught to laugh about it? In a lot of comedy, they have background laughter. Observe that the next time you watch comedy, if that's your thing, right? Back in the background, they'll put laughter. No one's actually laughing, but they have these sound effects. So then they teach you precisely at what points you are supposed to laugh. So the man's walking along the street, no one's laughing. So apparently you're not supposed to laugh at that. And then there's a banana peel. And then they slip. And they fall. And then there's laughter. So apparently you're supposed to laugh at such things. Little do you know that when your kids are sat down watching TV, they learn all this. And you thought comedy was innocent. This is all part of wrong thoughts. In the Noble Eightfold Path, you have Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappa. In the Ignoble Path, there isn't really one like that, but for the purpose of our discussion, Miccha Ditti, Miccha Sankappa. In Miccha Sankappa, you have three parts. Kama Sankappana, Vyapada Sankappana, and Vihinsa Sankappana. Kama is about sensuality. Vyapada is about anger, hatred, harboring resent and having a grudge, that sort of thing. Vihinsa is about hurting, causing discomfort and taking joy out of that. It's one of the things that takes you miles away from Nibbana, because you're rejoicing in someone's pain. But parents think it's okay to watch, for children to watch comedy. And then when children learn these things, if you remember when you were at school, like some of the things that kids do, guys walking down along the street or whatever, walk into a classroom, someone else comes and pulls it. What? You say it. Don't make me have to say that. Pulls down there? Yes, you know what. And as soon as they do that, what does everyone else do? Laugh. The poor boy who's just had his trousers pulled, how does he feel? He feels terrible. But everyone else is laughing at him. So what do we teach then our children? Rejoice in others' discomfort. Rejoice in others' pain. Rejoice in others' suffering. Every time you rejoice in that, you're earning demerit. This is sin. People don't realize it's sin. Remember, both sin and merit does not have to involve your hands. Doesn't have to. Plenty of times you've asked me, why is it just the gents who get to hold the mudukuda for the Swami Mahasayas when they walk into the Dhamma hall and so on? And I've always replied to you, it's not the hand that holds the umbrella that earns the merit. It's the mind that rejoices in it that earns the merit. Merit is not in the hand. If so, it has to be also in the umbrella, shouldn't it? It's not in the hand, it's in the mind that rejoices in it. Imagine there's a gent that's holding the umbrella thinking about the... Why do I always have to hold this monk? There have been times, like the other day, there was a gentleman who came to the monastery and he was not very happy about his niece, who had decided to become an anagarika with us. So this man, he was very, what shall we say? I'm trying to be polite. Let's just say he had a very materialistic view of the world. He doesn't accept this spirituality, you know, that wholesomeness, well-being. Oh, he doesn't believe in any of that. He thinks everything is just material. Okay? So, he was observing a gentleman walking a monk. Now, this is a gentleman, so he has every right to go and do that himself. But would he? You tell me after you've heard what he said. He said, why do these Rastiyadu monks have to be walked under these umbrellas like this? Can't they walk themselves and hold an umbrella by themselves? So that was his comment. All we have is empathy towards them. maybe a billion years ago, I might have said the same. So a billion years from now, he will regret having said that. But do you think he'll earn any merits by, if we were to give him the umbrella to hold it to the Swami Nuhasi, do you think he's going to earn any merits out of it? No. But he's holding the umbrella. That's not where merits are earned. It's in the mind that rejoices it. Now his niece is an anagarika. What do you think she's probably wishing for? In her mind, she's probably on her knees. Maybe that's her teacher who's been walked under the umbrella. With so much devotion, she's observing that and rejoicing in it. So who earns the merits? She earns the merits. So it's not the one who holds the umbrella. How did we get there? What was I talking about before that? What? What's that? Mind? Oh yeah, comedy, yes. Ah, thank you, madam. Yes, comedy. So, does it matter then who pulls the trousers? Does it matter then who throws the banana peel? That's what I was saying. As parents, we might think that it's just innocent entertainment. And you sit your child in front of the TV and he's watching, she or she's watching the TV, and you switch on the comedy channel. I mean, there are channels now dedicated to things like that, right? Comedy. Do you remember Tom and Jerry? We grew up with that stuff, didn't we? What do you think we were instilled with every time we watched one of those? Whenever, who was the cat? Tom was the cat. The mouse was Jerry, right? So whenever Jerry, the mouse, was able to play the trick on Tom the cat, because we never liked Tom. We always sided with the mouse because, you know, he's the little one, innocent one. And, you know, we've always known that the cats, they eat the rats. Right? So that's terrible. So they've picked the perfect characters for that. Right? But then whenever Tom was at the end of one of Jerry's antics, or when something that he did backfired, what did we do? We laughed. This is kids' entertainment. Don't you agree that they're earning sin, demerit as they watch that? Because now they're rejoicing in someone's suffering. It doesn't have to be a real person. You'll say, but sometimes it's just a cartoon. These are cartoon characters. They're not real people. Then how do you earn merits by offering flowers to the Buddha? That's not a real person. That's just a statue. We talked about this last week. It's all in the mind. You'll always find me talking about how children are wasted away in front of computer games. While in computer games, fighter, shooter games, robbing. Now there are a lot of games like that, aren't there? You snatch someone's car and then you just keep driving over people. And once in a while you get out and you find a club or something and just keep clubbing people with it and steal their money. And it's all just in a computer game, so it should be alright, shouldn't it? Then pornography should also be okay. Because it's all only on a computer screen. But whenever you have watched something like that, or played a computer game like that, have you not felt in your mind, in your heart, your pulse starts picking up pace, your blood starts running around your body, you start heating up. So is that not real then for you? Whenever desire arises in your mind, does your body not respond to that? So how can you tell me that that desire only arose by watching something that was fiction? It matters not. Because it's all in the mind. What's in the mind is true for you. That's what real is for you. Whether there's a component of that that is actually real in the outside world or not is irrelevant. There are two things here. There's one is karma, the other is karma pata. For a karma to take place, it doesn't have to be the real deal in the outside world. But the karma is already done. But the thing is, you know, I don't know how much of society we can go back and redo, or rather undo and do it right. Probably not much at all. Maybe it's too late. Maybe it's past the point of no return. Maybe. You know, 5,000 years was the lifespan of this sasana, and the Buddha proclaimed that. We've already gone past the half mark, right? We've already gone past that. So it can never be as good as it was. It can never be. From here on out, it's just going to be a continuous decline. But there's still the sasana left. It's still thriving. It's still there. It's never going to be as good and great as it was, but it's still there. There are still pockets of it here and there. You are all so very fortunate, myself included, to have come across the sasana. Today you're not here because I related a Jataka story to you. You know that. When was the last time I related a Jataka story to you? You are evidence that something's happening within you. That's what you come and lay at the feet of the Swaminarayan at the end of the sermon. You say, Swaminarayan, my life has transformed, it has changed. I was never the person that I am today. So much has changed, I can't express myself in words. And thank you, thank you, thank you, Swaminarayan. I say, yes, madam, thank you, thank you, thank you to the Buddha, to the Dhamma and the Sangha, because I know what you're talking about, because I've gone through the same thing. If it was my doing, how did I go through the same thing? Then it should have been a self-realization. It wasn't like that. If what you're going through, I've also gone through, then we both have the same source. I am not the source. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Now do you understand why it's called the refuge? That's why it's called the Noble Triple Gem. The only refuge, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. These sermons are for that. To free you from the burden of motherhood. To free you from the burden of fatherhood. Not to take your children away. Not to suggest that you must not continue to be mothers or fathers. That's your personal choice. That's a lifestyle choice. I'm not talking about lifestyle choices. I'm talking about mind style choices, if that's even a word. I mean, we invent things every day, don't we? Entitification. Rastiadification. No, that's a nice word. Some of these words, you know, they just don't have their English counterparts. They just, you know, like, the other day I was thinking, what's the best word for someone who's a Kalakanya? Time eater doesn't quite cut it. So we have to Anglicanize that word in some way. Time eater doesn't cut it. Like when we say, you know, don't waste their time. Like in Sinhalese, we might say, you know, rastiyadu karanne pa ekollonga ne something like that. So rastiyadification sounds like a better word. Those days I didn't used to know the word for a drizzle, so I called it potherization. Don't walk out when there's a potherization. Language is just language, you know. It's for our convenience. That's what I said. Freedom is not in the word. It's in the experience of freedom. The experience of freedom cannot be encapsulated into a word. And so when I say freedom, it means something to me. When you hear the word freedom, it means something else to you potentially. But to the degree to which we are both Sangha, that is the degree to which we both resonate when we say the same thing. When I say freedom, to the degree to which you are also Sangha, is the degree to which you experience what that actually means for you. Freedom. So have a goal in life, ladies and gentlemen. Set your ambitions right. We're almost at the... I think we're 1/3 of the year done, aren't we? Or a quarter? A quarter done? 2025, the rest of 2025 is going to be the same like what we've already spent. But remember, at the end of last year, I reminded you, this was the year when lots of misfortunate, unfortunate things are going to happen. This is the year your son, your daughter is going to leave you. This is the year you're going to learn that he or she is doing drugs. This is the year that someone in your family is going to pick up a terminal illness. You're going to get to hear about that. And you're going to have to face the truth. You're going to have to face the facts. I can't stop those things from happening in your lives. Some regulars in the sermons lately, they've come and told me, Swaminathan said, we are having to go abroad for our studies and so on. I said, okay, if that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. But please make sure that you keep yourself true to the Dhamma and keep yourself in the Dhamma, because noble association is the only savior that you can expect. Perhaps others are planning similar. Maybe you or someone you know, maybe your children. From time to time, you know, you will have to do it. You'll have to send your children abroad for studies, whatever, to settle down. Remember, it's a very different environment there. Very different. The culture is different. The philosophy is different. People are different. We're all Khatas and we all bleed the same. Yes, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the doctrine. I'm talking about the way that people think. This morning as we were driven in and I got out of the car, I was so pleased to see a little boy. He ran forward and he kicked off his slippers and he got on his knees and worshipped the Swaminarayan. Probably 7, 8, 9, something like that. He knew enough to kick off his slippers before worshipping the Swaminarayan. I was very impressed by that. And then I was reminded of my childhood. When I was that age, the first time I saw a monk, I walked up to him and gave my hand and said, good morning. Because that's what I knew. I did not have that environment in which I was exposed to the Mahasangha. I didn't know what to do. The problem was not in me extending my hand to them. The problem was I didn't know who the Sangha was. And by the Sangha, I don't mean someone who's a robe bearer. I mean someone who's a Chivara bearer. Different story. Chivara is the Sivara. That's why we call it the Sivara. Siv, four. Vara is boon. The four boons. The four boons are the four noble truths. That is what this robe represents. A bearer of the four noble truths. That's why it's called the Sivara. I didn't know that the Swaminarayana was a bearer of the Four Noble Truths. Had I known that, I would have not gone forward to him and extended my hand in that manner. I would have gotten on my knees and beseeched to be freed from suffering. But I was too young and I did not have the exposure, did not have the environment in which I was taught that there is such a thing called the Four Noble Truths. That happiness was not to be found in ice cream, in chocolate, in soft drinks, in food. Because even back then I was brought up in a foreign country and there we didn't have that. That was the first time I'd seen a monk. But this young boy here comes running to Swaminarayan, kicks his slippers off and he's on his knees. Your children that you bring here on Sundays, so Dasyandra's there talking to them. Actually, what they're doing is, what the Swaminarayan is doing in the other room is trying to make your children who you really wanted them to be when you had them, when you first had them. What good is your son and your daughter if all they have is a good education, but they don't know what it means when they say you are their mother? If to them the mother is the same as any other woman, or if all they see in a father is a provider, when they want some petty cash, father, when they want something nice, father, they want your money for the tuition classes, father, lunch money, father. If that's what father is, then the father is just a provider. You know what's going to happen then? When there comes a point where the father can no longer provide, now what is the father to them? Just a burden. An inconvenience, a nuisance. And so, what they'll try and do is find an old people's home and just dish them off into them and just say, good riddance. I have on some occasions talked to young people who have come and said, they're just a nuisance. I wish they were gone. I wish they were gone. They're just a hassle. They're just a botheration. They're just people I have to bump into at home. So we take our time and try to put sense into their heads and say, wait, young child, think about what you're saying. You don't understand who your parents are. But then, you know, why blame them now? It's too late. And then if you follow back the trail, you realize that what the parents wanted for their children when they were younger was just to put them into a good school and give them a good education. Not to do what you're doing with your children in the other room. You tell me if your son, your daughter, who you bring here every weekend, does not change gradually over the, you know, week on week. If that doesn't happen, you come and tell me. I'd be very surprised. If you don't see a positive change in them, how they are becoming more virtuous, more understanding, more patient, more tolerant, more understanding, more in sync with actually what's going on in the environment, who resonate with nature. If all your child wants is just to go home and sit down in front of his computer and start playing computer games, you know, there are kids like that. Unfortunately, maybe some of you have similar stories to say, but it means there are those who you know have such stories to say. All the children want is to, when they get back home from school, is sit down in front of their computers, and then lunch has to be served, has to be brought to the bedroom. Mom, hungry, that's it. So mother has to bring lunch and put it on the table. And they don't even look at the lunch. They take it while playing the computer game. They don't even know what they're eating. And if they can't even be bothered to take their hands off the console, then the mother has to still shove the food into their mouths. These things are happening, ladies and gentlemen. It's happening even in this country now. It didn't used to be like that. But we have globalized. Woohoo! We have globalized. There are some kids who all they do all day long is just play computer games. And what these games do? It completely destroys their mind. Like I said, violent games. You know, there's a game that has the name theft in it. I won't say any more. It has one of the 10 unmeritorious deeds in it. You need more convincing? What's the next one you want? Grand adultery. Grand murder? This is gamification of sin. Wake up, folks. Gamification of sin. I can't fault people who produce these games because they don't know the truth. They don't realize that if it's just on a computer game, it still does the same harm. They don't know that because they don't have the dhamma, but you do. So you need to think twice. Not twice, but 200 times. If your children are still playing these kind of games at home, forgive me for saying this, but I have to ask the question, do they deserve parents like you? Or do they deserve better? A parent is someone who should be accountable, who should be responsible, who should know what is right and wrong for their child, because the child does not have the intelligence, the knowledge, the know-how to understand what's right or wrong. That's why they call it children. They're childish. You're the one who has to make the right choices. To make the right choices, ladies and gentlemen, you have to learn these choices and their consequences. What their ramifications are. It's not enough just to learn, just to know how to have a child. Far more important it is to know how to bring one up. That's why we sometimes spend time talking about the such things here as well. Because these are things we know and we employ in bringing our children up at the monastery. They don't play computer games. Because they don't need that kind of entertainment. Because they're always entertained. When you're always happy, why do you need entertainment? If someone needs entertainment, what does that tell you about them? They're not happy. So if someone's always happy, do they need additional forms of entertainment? No. Because here's what we teach our children. If ever you vex, dear child, vexation is a product of the mind. Because it's all in the mind. It's a creation of the mind. That's your ignorance that's creating that. It's your attachment that is rooted in ignorance that creates that vexation. So once we talk to them, they understand the concept. Then they begin to apply the principles. Sunita and Sopaka were only 7 years of age. So don't tell me that these children are too young to understand the Dhamma. Then go back and rewrite history before you come and talk to me. So Nitan Sopaka, only 7 years of age. Prince Rahula. It's, you know, it's all about the environment. At what age do you think a child's mind can be distorted in such a way that they begin to see the female body as a sexual object? At what age do you think that's possible? Well, you go back into your history and you ask yourself, when did that first happen to me? Probably the first feminine touch that you might have had was from your mother. You fed on her milk. How then did you begin to see the same organ as something other than your source of life? At some point in your life that happened. Yes or no? At some point in your life that happened. Today there are kids as young as 7, 8, 9 who watch porn. If they can get porn at 7 and understand porn, how come they can't understand the Dharma? Of course they can. We must give our children a fighting chance. What we were not availed of when we were younger, we were given math, we were given science, we were given Buddhism as a religion, but hardly the philosophy of Buddhism. What we were not availed of, we must provide to our children. Just because you and I didn't have it when we were younger doesn't mean our children are not entitled to it. This is the dawn of a new era, ladies and gentlemen. The sasana is here. Agreed, it is not going to be as good as it was back then, but it's still here. It goes up and down like a sine curve. There are peaks and then there are troughs. We are approaching a peak, I feel. Ride it, is my invitation to you. Ride it. But remember, after every peak comes a trough. Don't wait it out too long. It may not be another 500, 600 years before there's another peak. You will have lived, born, and died at least 6 or 7 times before the next peak comes along. And then you have to be born into the right environment, among noble associates, with enough merits, and a human being. For all these causes to align together and to come in this arrangement, remember, this is also anicca. What you are presented with today, this opportunity, is a manifestation of causes. Just imagine if all of this were true but you didn't speak English or Sinhalese. How could I help you now? You'll have to wait until I finish learning Spanish. But let's say you spoke the language, but you were not born to Buddhist parents. It takes a lot then to overcome that. Because in some teachings, some religions, it is completely against the religion itself. It goes completely against their basic fundamentals to actually even listen to a talk that prescribes or teaches something against, or that does not align with their spiritual teachings or what's in the scriptures of that particular religion. So then you will approach that right from the onset. You will approach it with friction, and you may not even come. What if you are not within earshot? What if you are born in another country? See, our monks, they get invited from time to time to visit these countries. Just imagine if you lived in one of those countries. Then you'd have to wait. Once a year you get a Swami Nansi. once a year. Now you get it every week. If you come to Sudhaminasugam, you get it every day. If you come into the monastery, you get it all the time. Shall I tell you something that's going to give you a great deal of envy? Guru Hamra's kuti is next to mine. Sorry. From my window I can talk to him. Merits, that's all it is. But I appreciate that it is merits and it is also anicca. It is conditioned. This situation, this opportunity is also conditioned, meaning I will not have it forever. I know that. Therefore, this peak on which I find myself, I intend to ride, and I ride it well. Because I am not going to watch it pass under my nose and then years later regret not having done what I should have done when I had everything going for me. So then I have to ask all of you again, are you doing everything that you should be doing, you ought to be doing, when you have everything going for you right now? Are you where you need to be? Are you where you are supposed to be? Are you where you ought to be? You may be where circumstances have made you be, but is that where you want to be? If where you are does not tally with where you want to be, do something. You can think, you can act, you can make decisions, you have choices. Whatever choice you make, yes, of course, the consequences as well as the rewards are yours. But remember, whatever story that you have woven for yourself, whatever tale that you are telling for yourself, when that last tick goes tock, that's the end of that chapter. You don't even remember your grandmother's full name today. So what are you waiting to be? A grandmother. Madam, your daughter's daughter will not remember your name. She won't even bother asking your name. That's why it's incumbent upon each and every one of you to do what you have to do for your own salvation. Don't count on others to catch you when you fall. Make sure you can stand up straight on your own 2 feet. There will come a point soon enough where you are a mere inconvenience. At that point, they will just wish that you were gone sooner rather than later. Just imagine if you were just plugged into a machine. You know, sometimes people come and ask us this question. Swami answer, my mother, she's on the machine. Should I or shouldn't I? Did you know? I mean, just think about it. Someone's going to ask this question about you one day. You're on a machine, right? And you can't respond because you're not fully conscious. But someone's going to come and ask, my mother, my father, should I or shouldn't I? What are they asking about, really? Whether they should switch you off or keep you going. Your life has come to that. So then we ask, what are the pros and the cons? Well, the only con is if I do that myself, then I'm committing a sin. That's the only con. So the only reason that someone's not unplugging you from the system is because it's sinful to the person who does it. Is that what your life's come to? The consequences far outweigh the inconvenience. That's why they keep you going. give yourself a pat on the shoulder, if it ever comes to that. There are times when children come and ask us those questions because it's a big problem to them. So of course, on those occasions, we tell them, you know, how about you get yourself out of that and get someone else to make that decision? Don't you get involved? But that's besides the point. The point is this. People don't switch you off simply because it's more of a consequential decision for them than the inconvenience of keeping you going. If that consequence weren't there, you tell me, what would they do? That's it. You're on the path to that end, that ugly end. I'm talking about death not because death is some kind of morbid. I don't have a morbid fascination with death. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about death from time to time because before it comes to that point, you have to do something. Death is actually overrated. I don't care much about death. But what I do care about is what you do before you die. And before you get to the point where your life is in the hands of someone else. Before then, folks, you have to do something for yourselves. And we have the Sasana here with us. We have the Dhamma here with us. We have Noble Association here with us. We have people who care about us enough to come here every weekend. I have to leave my teacher to come here every day. So the previous night I go to him and say, Guru Handra, I'm leaving tomorrow to Rajagiri. I make my worship to you and please give me your blessing so that I will not come to any misfortune along the way. I have to leave my teacher, I have to leave my Noble Association, I have to leave the Swaminarayans and come here and I talk to you. There are people who care about us enough to do that. There are people who care about you enough to make sure that you're not hungry when you get here. That you're comfortable when you're here. Do you think the school has to make sure that this room is clean, tidy, the fans are working, the AC is on? Do you think the school has any obligation to do that? No. Why should anyone be bothered about your Nibbana? Why should anyone be bothered about your Nibbana? Nibbana is where they don't get anything from you. If the school were interested in getting your children into the school, then yes, fair enough. Like that'd be an open day. Get the parents to come in, prospective parents. Like get them to come in, then they'll treat you like royalty. Yes, of course. Then they'll bring you into the same hall. Maybe offer you food and drinks and make sure the toilets are clean and decorate the whole place and make you feel like, you know, give you the preferential premium treatment. But how come they give you the same hall? They give you the same facilities. They give you the same comforts, expecting nothing from you in return. Where do you find people like that? I'll tell you where you find people like that. People who don't want what you have. People who don't want anything from you. My point is, we are still so very fortunate to have among us such people and to be in their presence. Life has been kind to you, ladies and gentlemen, remember this. Life has been so kind to you and kept you alive until you came across the Dhamma. Your heart has been so kind to you and kept beating all this while. What if it gave up 2 years ago? What if your heart gave up 2 years ago? And when it was on the verge of doing so, what if the doctors didn't intervene? Maybe some among you had heart attacks. Whatever. What if the doctors hadn't intervened? They kept you going. What I'm saying is this. This is what life is worth for. So that you can make the most of life. Don't live just because you were born. You don't have to do that for that. Do anything for that. Do you agree? Don't live just because you were born. You know, cats and dogs and cattle, they do that. They live because they're born. You know, a dog has no way of committing suicide. He doesn't know how to do that. Just imagine a dog is really vexed about something. What can it do? Yeah, besides barking, what else can it do? It's just imagine there's a famine and there's no grass to eat and the poor cow hungry, starving, but don't know what to do. Can't feed its cattle, its calves. Or the mother dog cannot feed its puppies. What does a mother human do? She goes and commits suicide with the children. What does the dog do? It doesn't know how to commit suicide. So it has to live because it's born. It has to live out its existence because it was born. We humans should not be like that, should we? We must not find ourselves in a situation where we just get through the days. As every day as it comes, we just get through the day. Each day as it comes, we just get through the day. Getting through the day is not something very human to do. Get something from the day. That is very human. That's a very human, intelligent thing to do. Don't get through your days, get something from your days. Make each day count. So come closer to the Sangha. You have done that physically today. That's where this conversation started, and I forgot to present you as well. Before I finish, I will. And the beauty of editing is you can cut that part and stick it at the beginning and pretend like that's how I did it. No, but seriously, you know what? Take matters into your own hands, folks. For your own sake, I mean. Take matters in your own hands. It's very important you do that. No one will care about you as much as you care about yourself. Most people only care about what they can get from you, not what they can get for you. Unless you come across someone who doesn't want something that you have, they will always try to get something from you. The day you come across someone who doesn't want anything that you have, they'll try to get something for you. Today, we are fortunate to be in the presence of those who want something for us, not something from us. Make use of that opportunity. It doesn't come every day. Trust me, it doesn't come every day. You know from your own life, you know from your own life, from the day your child was born, what did the child want? Something for you or something from you? Mothers, let's go back even before they were born. When you carried them in your womb for 9 long months, did they bring something for you or did they take something from you? They took something from you. Then after they were born, still they took something from you. And from the first 5-6 years, what did they do? Yes, you say, you know, they made me happy. They made me, I was watching the child's antics, you know, playing around with the toys and running around. It made me really happy. But if you put all those things on a scale, considering all things, right? All those times where you laughed and the times where you cried and you were worried and you were dead scared and you lived in fear, right? pulling your hair out. Every nappy that you had to change. Are you telling me you did it with a lot of fun? Huh? Why don't you go and walk in the work in the children's ward? There are lots of nappies to change. You were waiting for the day that the child was going to grow up, so you didn't have to do that anymore. Gone that days where you go and change the nappy and ask, what did you eat? There were days where you'd ask yourself, did that come out of you? No, you were all there, human bodies. But besides the physical pain that you had to endure, the psychological torment that you had to go through. And that was just one of them. But then mothers, they have these things called postnatal depression and stuff like that. Where does that come from? And there are mothers who have to go through all that as well. You don't expect that. If you knew that you'd have to go through something like that, perhaps you might have had a different choice. I can't say for sure, but sometimes I'm surprised how mothers go through labor and then they go through that again and again and again and again. But motherhood, that's what motherhood is, apparently. You forget all the pain that you had to go through, apparently. I hope I'm not insulting mothers. I have one myself, you know that, right? So I would never insult mothers, but I feel for mothers. I feel for those who have to bear the burden of motherhood, the pain that you have to endure. The truth is this though, you are not really a mother. You're just a mind that thinks you're a mother. That's the thing. You wake up one morning and realize you are in the body of a woman. So then this body keeps growing, and then society tells you that you have to become a mother now. Then you just follow their teaching, that's all. 99% of all your choices were not your choices really. They were choices, you can't really call them choices. They were decisions that were made by others on your behalf. See, society has a real way of tailoring you to what they need. That's why you have a profession that meets society's needs. Just think about whatever you do in society. When you were growing up, did you not have this question, what should I be when I grow up? Very seldom would one have this, I want to find freedom when I grow up. Hardly anyone's like that. I wasn't like that when I was younger. I didn't identify myself as a freedom seeker. That's not how I identified myself. As early as I could start piecing things together, society told me that I had to become a doctor. So who wanted that from me? Society. Society needed doctors and I had to become one. Society needed teachers, so you had to become one. Society needed fishermen, so what must you do? Become one. One day society will need an executioner. I think the last time they put out a job posting for it, how many people had it applied? If I remember right, I think 300 or so applications had gone in. Because when society needs an executioner and they're bringing the laws to legalize execution, by presidential order, then you have to become one. Someone has to become one. Just think about it. Someone in society has to become one. Perhaps the child that you're going to have is going to be the executioner of the country in 25 years' time. That's not what you want for your child. So whoever became the executioner, do you think that person's mother wanted him to become the executioner? when she had him? Certainly not. But when society needs that, you have to become that. See, that's what I'm saying. These choices that you think you have made, ladies and gentlemen, they're not really your choices, but decisions that have been made for you. It's a bit like this. You know, I say, pick a card, and I put three cards in front of you. Have I not already picked the three of them for you? This is not completely your choice now, is it? I've already limited you down to three choices. So who's decided that? I have decided that. So I will only present to you cards that I don't mind whichever one you pick. So when you were born, society put some cards in front of you and said, doctor, engineer, lawyer, teacher, nurse, executioner. Pick one. So then you picked one. Then tell me, from the day you started and you thought you had to have a career, the day you start to recognize and identify yourself as someone who has to be on a career pathway, maybe you were 14, maybe you were 15, from there on end, you've always been working to that. See, you're all living a life that someone else has decided for you. That's why you have to go against the stream. The world does not want you to exit. The world wants to keep you in this vortex. You have to be inside of this. What does a ruler want? People to be ruled. Think about it. A ruler will always want people so that he can rule over them. So just imagine we had a world ruler. A leader for the entire world, imagine there was someone like that. Right? What would they want? They want you to be in or out. In, so that they can rule you. If you start to cause trouble, then what do? They put you in the penitentiary, in the prison. And then they reform you. That's what they call reformation centers. They reform you. What's that? What does that mean? Let's say you have a habit of walking backwards. That's your thing. You walk backwards. What do they put you? Into the mental hospital. And then try and do what? Get you to walk forwards. Because that's what society wants from you. So don't you come telling me that we are free people, we have free choices and we do as we please. Not so, ladies and gentlemen. You pick from a selection that has already been picked on your behalf. It's like a play. There are many actors, but they're all acting out scripts that were written by the same scriptwriter. That's not freedom. I don't know whether I'm making sense, because this is kind of like you've been seeing the world in black and white, and all of a sudden I'm showing you the world in color. It's like a completely different paradigm. I'm asking you to broaden your horizons and actually look 180 degrees in the other direction. This is not a 360 degree turn, because you'd be back where you started. This is a 180 degree turn. When you're standing upside down all your life, I'm saying, hey, stand on your feet and now look at the world. So this will go against many of the things that you held dear and true all your life. So much so that this should not... Sometimes I feel that these talks should be made illegal. Because everyone got to hear this, then perhaps the rulers won't be able to rule you. They'll have to shut down the stores. They'll have to shut down the supermarkets. They'll have to shut down the boutiques. They'll have to shut down the fashion stores. No more catwalks. No more restaurants. No more 5 stars. Because you will realize that that is not what we were born for. No more theme parks. So the, I don't know. But I talk to you because you come here, you want to listen to what we have to say. Remember, the Dhamma is your only refuge. Tissue papers, whether you like it or not, society will treat you like one. We have one better than tissue paper, right? Yes. Tissue papers only end up in the waste paper bin. The other one ends in the commode. What do people wipe with that? You know what. So please work on your salvation. We are at a peak. Ride it. This peak will not last forever. Perhaps the peak will fall, or perhaps you will fall. If either of these two things happen, you have lost the opportunity. Don't gamble with life. Please remember that, don't gamble with life. Your age is only an indication of how long you have lived. It is not an indication of how long you will live. Don't forget that. At the end of this year, a few of you will stop coming to this sermon. That's not because you have fallen out with me. It's because you will have given up on life. But remember, it's not the oldest one first. It's not a first in, first out. It's first in, any out. In random order. When it's your time, it's your time. So if I ask you who's the next one to go, you should all be putting your hand up and saying, Swami, no, so potentially me. Or shall we all find the oldest person in the audience? That's why the other day I suggested, if you have spare time, commit that towards your salvation. Don't look for the next business enterprise. Don't look for the next contract if you don't need it. If you need it, go for it. If you can't make ends meet, ladies and gentlemen, then yes, absolutely. If your current job does not provide for your family, go and find another one. Do that. If working weekdays is not sufficient to feed your family and you need to start working one day a weekend, then do that as well. If you have to do it, do it. If it has to be Sunday, then it has to be Sunday. I get that. But if you have enough to survive, remember, you can only put one meal into your stomach at a time. So all that food in the fridge, you may eat it, you may not eat it. You have to live long enough to eat it. Or do you feel like you have to own the entire supermarket? Survive. When it comes to the four requisites, your strategy should be survival. Remember that. When it comes to food, your strategy should be survival. A roof above your head, what should your strategy be? Survival. Clothing? Survival. Medicines? I think that's obvious. No one takes two pills when they can do with one. So that should be survival. Your strategy should be survival. Not to thrive, but to survive. That's what you need, the four requisites. That's what we do as monks. Your life and my life are not really very different when it comes to lives. We are the same. The only difference is this. A very small proportion of my life have I put towards my survival. Because I just need to survive physically. Because I have a bigger thing to do now that I'm here. I have bigger fish to fry. I don't care what car I get driven around in. I don't care. As long as my hunger is sated and my thirst is quenched, as long as I'm physically fit to do what I have to do for the day, I don't care what I eat. As long as when the sun is scorching hot, I have shelter. And when it's raining cats and dogs, I have something to keep me dry. I don't frankly care what's above my head or what's around my waist. I don't care. Because I don't care about those things, I have plenty of time to do the things I truly care about. The things that really matter. It matters not whether your house is one story high or seven stories high. Both of those you will leave when you go. A man who has only eaten one slice of bread versus a man who has eaten the full feast. If it's their last meal, won't they both die? Won't they both die? And when they're dead, won't they both be the same? Dead is the same, right? When the coroner comes and cuts open their stomach, they will find, in one you will find a slice of bread, in the other you will find a feast. That's the difference. But they're both well and truly dead. Now what good is the bread, what good is the feast? They're both dead. But just imagine if that man who only ate a slice of bread, because that was enough for them, for the day, just for the day, or until they get to the next meal, and then they save that time to work on their mind, on their spiritual development, to go to a Dhamma talk, to meditate, to contemplate the truth of life, to reflect on reality, to free themselves from suffering. Whatever they have done towards that, that will remain with them. Where's the other man? He wanted a feast. And because he wanted a feast, he's been working on that for the whole week. Going shopping, buying stuff, cooking stuff, finding all these fancy recipes so that he could try something new every day. A human being. Don't waste your life. Don't take your life casually. Then you become a casualty. Be very serious about life. This may be the only chance you get. When you see the cats and dogs and stray animals running all around, in Colombo you don't get much of that, but as you start going to the suburbs, right, you see stray animals running here and there. So just look at the bird on the tree, or the crows that feast on dead animals. You know, that was once a human being who wanted a feast. So they didn't have time to work on their spiritual salvation, on their mental liberation. Because they didn't have time for that, they were just feasting, feasting, feasting. Trying to satisfy their sensual desires. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Remember, that's not what you were born for. You were born for freedom. Don't just live because you were born, ladies and gentlemen. Live with purpose. If you don't have purpose, then you are just... just a leaf blowing in the wind. An autumn leaf just blowing in the wind. You never know where you land. I'm talking to you like this because I care. Because you have nothing that I want. So trust my words. Because I have nothing that you want. I'm not saying this for your pirikara. Hopefully you know that. If you want me to prove that, stop offering pirikara from here on end. And see whether I'm going to stop coming to Rajgiri. This is not for your alms food. This is because inside each and every one of you, there's an innocent mind. It's very innocent. It's so innocent, it doesn't know what the heck's going on. it's so innocent, that it's so ignorant, and it thinks that it's a self. It has taken up an identity that is beyond a mind itself. And then it looks either side of it and it says, oh, my son, oh, my husband, my wife, oh, my family. Hey. I have to look after them. And I have to worry about them. I have to commit my life to them, says a mind that's gone insane. About that mind I care. And now let me tell you why, one last word, why I care about that mind. Because that mind is the same as this mind. If I care about a mind, it should matter not to me whether I care about that mind or this mind. Because all minds are born equal. If I'm more concerned about this mind than I'm about that mind, then it cannot be minds I'm talking about. Then I'm just as ignorant. That's why sometimes people ask, once an arahant becomes an arahant, why does an arahant care about others? Because an arahant doesn't care about others, they care about minds. It is because an arahant cares about minds, they became an arahant. An arahant is a mind that is free of suffering. But as soon as this mind has achieved that freedom from suffering, it sees there are plenty of other minds that are still suffering. So, the degree to which an arahant cares about a mind has not changed, so then they go on rendering that service so that they can free as many minds as possible for as long as they're alive. That's why an arahant continues to render their service. So, my task is really to try and free yourselves from yourselves. Because you are not who you think you are. You have burdened your minds with this identity that you have created within yourself. Actually, you are your biggest curse, to put it quite simply. What you are doing to yourself is the biggest torture. So I'm really trying to free your minds from whom? From yourself. If you would only let me do what I want to do to you and stop doing what you are doing to your mind, right? There would be peace in this world. But your world is on fire because you're trying to do something with your mind and it goes against what a mind was born for. It goes against God's agenda, it goes against Vipaka's agenda, it goes against the Buddha's agenda, and it goes against what the mind was born for. It is not natural. What you're doing is something very artificial. I should probably precept you before we conclude. See, in some ways, it's probably better to precept you at the end. I'll tell you why though. It's because when you precept now, you understand the significance of that precepting. Whereas when you do it at the beginning, it's just, you're repeating what I say. I don't mean all of you. I mean, let's say there are some newcomers or people who are new to the doctrine, new to the Dhamma. So I say, let's all chant the Namaskar. And so Swami now says Namodas. Everyone says Namodas. Swami says Buddhan Sarnanga. Buddhan Sarnanga Chami. But what does it actually mean? Why Buddhan Sarnanga Chami? Why Dhamman Sarnanga Chami? But now you understand why. I don't think when the Buddha gave preachings, just can you imagine that in the deer park? The five ascetics sat down in front of the Buddha. How many of them Buddhists? How many Buddhists? None. In fact, they were so prepared to reject the Buddha, right? They said, this fellow, he was with us earlier, then he gave up. How can he have become a Buddha? Fine, but he's the son of the king, so we should probably sit down and listen to what he has to say. So then, do you think if the Buddha had sat down and said, okay, now please recite after me, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. I take refuge in the Buddha. If the Buddha had asked the five ascetics to do that, what would they have done? They would have stood up and walked away. I mean, they would have said, don't take any liberties. Right? We are offering you our courtesy. As a matter of courtesy, we are prepared to sit down and listen to you. But then, hey, Buddhang Sarnang Gacchami, that's one step too far. If you think we are going to repeat that, you've got another thing coming. That's what they would have said. But you know, at the end of that talk, the Buddha did not have to precept them. One of them became a Sotapanna. In other words, he internally went and found refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. That is what becoming a Sotapanna is. You realize this is the only stream to happiness, the stream of Nibbana, the stream of the Noble Eightfold Path that gets me to the ocean of Nibbana. Once you've entered the stream, the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha are your only refuge. You don't need anyone to precept you. You are precepted. Refuge becomes part of who you are. At the end of the second talk, all of them are arahants. No precepting required. So why do we precept today then? You tell me that you have all become arahants. I won't be precepting you. If there's anyone here who's not prepared and willing to come with me back to the Manushya and say, Swaminas, I've realized, right, the Noble Eightfold Path is the only way to go. I'm convinced, right, complete conviction. I realize now that the Buddha is the only destination, the Dhamma is the only doctrine, and the Sangha is the only practice that can take me to my liberation. My children, my husband, my wife, my food, my property, my money, none of these things can bring me any happiness. Trust me, I don't need to precept you anymore. I don't need to precept you from there on, because you are precepted. You are precepted in the doctrine. That is your precept. This is a ritual. This is a custom. But this is not what I want. I will do this anyway, but I'd rather save these 5 minutes and talk to you the Dhamma. That's what I'd rather do. In the 5 or 10 minutes that we take to precept you, you don't really learn much. You don't become a Buddhist by mere, reciting. You don't become a Buddhist that way. A Buddhist is not in a repetition or a recitation. A Buddhist is your thought process. Buddhist is just this, when you have realized that happiness is only to be found within. That is a Buddhist. But then I will do my duty and I will precept you. Otherwise, one of these days someone will come up and stand and say, Swami Nuhansa, are you even a monk? Aren't you supposed to precept us? What about all these customs and rituals and rites that we have to adhere to? Then I'll have to go to Mahanayaka Andhru and... long story. So, much easier to just do what I have to do. But we must not think of this merely as a waste of time. I don't think you will. What I want you to do is contemplate on this, on what you're saying. When you say, Buddhang Sarnang, Dhammang Sarnang, Sanghang Sarnang Gacchami, contemplate on what it means. Otherwise we might as well just sing Baba Black Sheep. Isn't it? Contemplate on what it means. Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. I take refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha is not the person. It's too late to take refuge in him. He's gone. Buddha is the truth. I take refuge in the truth. Dhamma is the doctrine. Dhamma is what you have to understand to realize that truth. That's the Dhamma. I don't need to convince you to take refuge in it if you have understood what we've been talking about so far. And then Sangha is your practice. How do you practice the Dhamma to get to Buddha? That giving up the unmeritorious deeds, engaging in meritorious deeds, sabbabhava sakarana, kusala supasampada, satitta pariyodapana. This is Sangha. That is Sangha. Etam buddhana sasana. That is a sasana. So as you recite these, contemplate on them. So vai dutiya api tatiyampi. First, second and third, on three occasions I take this. So if you like, you can think through my mind, through my speech, through my body. In all three ways, I adhere to the Noble Triple Gem. So what does that mean? In my thoughts, I will only conduct myself in a manner that is conducive to my Nibbana. In my speech, I will only conduct myself in a manner that is conducive to Nibbana. In my actions, I will only conduct myself in a manner that is conducive to Nibbana. Make that promise to yourselves. You don't have to say it out loud even. What if you are mute? Then can you not become a Buddhist? What if you weren't able to pronounce the Pali? I say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. I mean, let's say there's someone who is an Englishman. What would the Englishman say? Buddhang Saranang Gacchami or something like that. But I've just said Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. He's just said something else. It matters not. It matters not one bit. You don't have to be able to pronounce these words properly. But this is only for your own knowledge, okay? Between you and I. Outside, you have to spell it syllable by syllable properly. Alright, let's take a moment then. Okay, let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today then. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this maze to all the monks and nuns resident throughout the world, including in your local temples and nunneries. They have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to Guru Swami Mahansa, my teacher, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to friends of our monastery, the devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who provide the Mahasangha with your support the Mahasangha with your know-how and your well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, employers and employees, as well as our teachers, our friends and all and one and all who have taken every effort to help make our lives as comfortable as they could. They've left no stone unturned and supported us and assisted us and helped us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they also be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones who have passed away in our name, to our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers to us, fathers to us, friends to us, And with an abundance of loving kindness and compassion towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we will to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants of this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a rahatan mahanse or an arahat teranin mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sambhut Dasasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnan midatva desha ginnan midatva moha ginnan midatva nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravitma Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satmayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravitma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravitma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansapa labeva nivansapa labeva nivansapa labeva
Thunduvange suvisi ananta mahaguna belen siyalu loka siyalu sattayoma nibbana parama sukhayan suvithi taravetva sadhu sadhu sadhu